5, outlawing discrimination against Negroes using public facilities, was nullified by the Supreme Court, which said, "Individual invasion of individual rights is not the subject matter of the amendment." The 14th Amendment, it said, was aimed at state action only. No state shall. A remarkable dissent was written by Supreme Court Justice John Harlan, himself a former slave owner in Kentucky, who said there was constitutional justification for banning private discrimination. He noted that the 13th Amendment, which banned slavery, applied to individual plantation owners, not just the state. He then argued that discrimination was a badge of slavery and similarly outlawable. He pointed also to the first clause of the 14th Amendment, saying that anyone born in the United States was a citizen, and to the clause in Article 4, Section 2, saying, "The citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states." Harlan was fighting a force greater than logic or justice. The mood of the court reflected a new coalition of northern industrialists and southern businessmen planters. The culmination of this mood came in the decision of 1896, Plessy v. Ferguson, when the court ruled that a railroad could segregate black and white if the segregated facilities were equal. The object of the amendment was undoubtedly to enforce the absolute equality of the two races before the law, but in the nature of things, it could not have been intended to abolish distinctions based upon color, or to enforce social as distinguished from political equality, or a commingling of the two races upon terms unsatisfactory to either. Harlan again dissented. "Our Constitution is colorblind." It was the year 1877 that spelled out clearly and dramatically what was happening. When the year opened, the presidential election of the past November was in bitter dispute. The Democratic candidate, Samuel Tilden, had 184 votes and needed one more to be elected. His popular vote was greater by 250,000. The Republican candidate, Rutherford Hayes, had 166 electoral votes. Three states not yet counted had a total of 19 electoral votes. If Hayes could get all of those, he would have 185 and be president. This is what his managers proceeded to arrange. They made concessions to the Democratic Party and the White South, including an agreement to remove Union troops from the South, the last military obstacle to the reestablishment of white supremacy there. Northern political and economic interests needed powerful allies and stability in the face of national crisis. The country had been in economic depression since 1873, and by 1877, farmers and workers were beginning to rebel. As C. Van Woodward puts it in his history of the 1877 Compromise, Reunion and Reaction, "It was a depression year, the worst year of the severest depression yet experienced. In the East, labor and the unemployed were in a bitter and violent temper. Out West, a tide of agrarian radicalism was rising. From both East and West came threats against the elaborate structure of protective tariffs, national banks, railroad subsidies, and monetary arrangements upon which the new economic order was founded. It was a time for reconciliation between Southern and Northern elites." Woodward asks, "Could the South be induced to combine with the Northern conservatives and become a prop instead of a menace to the new capitalist order? With billions of dollars worth of slaves gone, the wealth of the old South was wiped out. They now look to the national government for help, credit, subsidies, flood control projects. The United States in 1865 had spent $103,294,501 on public works, but the South received only $9,469,363. For instance, while Ohio got over $1 million, Kentucky, her neighbor south of the river, got $25,000. While Maine got $3 million, Mississippi got $136,000. While 83 million had been given to subsidize the Union Pacific and Central Pacific railroads, thus creating a transcontinental railroad through the North, there was no such subsidy for the South. So one of the things the South looked for was federal aid to the Texas and Pacific Railroad. Woodward says, by means of appropriations, subsidies, grants, and bonds, such as Congress had so lavishly showered upon capitalist enterprise in the North, the South might yet mend its fortunes, or at any rate the fortunes of a privileged elite. These privileges were sought with the backing of poor white farmers, brought into the new alliance against blacks. The farmers wanted railroads, harbor improvements, flood control, and, of course, land. Not knowing yet how these would be used, not to help them, but to exploit them. For example, as the first act of the new North-South capitalist cooperation, the Southern Homestead Act, which had reserved all federal lands, one-third of the area of Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, for farmers who would work the land, was repealed. This enabled absentee speculators and lumbermen to move in and buy up much of this land. And so the deal was made. The proper committee was set up by both houses of Congress to decide where the electoral votes would go. The decision was, they belonged to Hayes, and he was now president. As Woodward sums it up, the Compromise of 1877 did not restore the old order in the South. It did assure the dominant whites political autonomy and non-intervention in matters of race policy, and promised them a share in the blessings of the new economic order. In return, the South became, in effect, a satellite of the dominant region. The importance of the new capitalism in overturning what black power existed in the post-war South is affirmed by Horace Mann Bond's study of Alabama Reconstruction, which shows, after 1868, a struggle between different financiers. Yes, racism was a factor, but accumulations of capital and the men who controlled them were as unaffected by attitudinal prejudices as it is possible to be. Without sentiment, without emotion, those who sought profit from an exploitation of Alabama's natural resources turned other men's prejudices and attitudes to their own account, and did so with skill and ruthless acumen. It was an age of coal and power, and northern Alabama had both. The bankers in Philadelphia and New York, and even in London and Paris, had known this for almost two decades. The only thing lacking was transportation. And so, in the mid-1870s, Bond notes, northern bankers began appearing in the directories of southern railroad lines. J.P. Morgan appears by 1875 as director for several lines in Alabama and Georgia. In the year 1886, Henry Grady, an editor of the Atlanta Constitution, spoke at a dinner in New York. In the audience were J.P. Morgan, H.M. Flagler, an associate of Rockefeller, Russell Sage, and Charles Tiffany. His talk was called The New South, and his theme was, let bygones be bygones. Let us have a new era of peace and prosperity. The Negro was a prosperous laboring class. He had the fullest protection of the laws and the friendship of the Southern people. Grady joked about the Northerners who sold slaves to the South and said the South could now handle its own race problem. He received a rising ovation, and the band played Dixie. That same month, an article in the New York Daily Tribune. The leading coal and iron men of the South, who have been in this city during the last 10 days, will go home to spend the Christmas holidays thoroughly satisfied with the business of the year and more than hopeful for the future. And they have good reason to be. The time for which they have been waiting for nearly 20 years, when northern capitalists would be convinced not only of the safety, but of the immense profits to be gained from the investment of their money in developing the fabulously rich coal and iron resources of Alabama, Tennessee, and Georgia, has come at last. The North, it must be recalled, did not have to undergo a revolution in its thinking to accept the subordination of the Negro. When the Civil War ended, 19 of the 24 northern states did not allow blacks to vote. By 1900, all the southern states, in new constitutions and new statutes, had written into law the disenfranchisement and segregation of Negroes. And a New York Times editorial said, "Northern men no longer denounce the suppression of the Negro vote. The necessity of it under the supreme law of self-preservation is candidly recognized." While not written into law in the North, the counterpart in racist thought and practice was there. An item in the Boston Transcript, September 25, 1895. "A colored man who gives his name as Henry W. Turner was arrested last night on suspicion of being a highway robber. He was taken this morning to Black's studio, where he had his picture taken for the Rogues Gallery. That angered him, and he made himself as disagreeable as he possibly could. Several times along the way to the photographers, he resisted the police with all his might and had to be clubbed." In the post-war literature, images of the Negro came mostly from Southern white writers like Thomas Nelson Page, who in his novel, Red Rock, referred to a Negro character as a hyena in a cage, a reptile, a species of worm, a wild beast. And interspersed with paternalistic urgings of friendship for the Negro, Joel Chandler Harris, in his Uncle Remus stories, would have Uncle Remus say, "Put a spelling book in a nigger's hands, and right then and there you loses a plow hand. I can take a barrel stave and fling more sense into a nigger in 1 minute than all the schoolhouses between this and the state of Michigan." In this atmosphere, it was no wonder that those Negro leaders most accepted in white society, like the educator Booker T. Washington, a one-time White House guest of Theodore Roosevelt, urged Negro political passivity. Invited by the white organizers of the Cotton States, an international exposition in Atlanta in 1895 to speak, Washington urged the Southern Negro to cast down your bucket where you are. That is, to stay in the South, to be farmers, mechanics, domestics, perhaps even to attain to the professions. He urged white employers to hire Negroes rather than immigrants of strange tongue and habits. Negroes, without strikes and labor wars, were the most patient, faithful, law-abiding, and unresentful people that the world has seen. He said, "The wisest among my race understand that the agitation of questions of social equality is the extremest folly." Perhaps Washington saw this as a necessary tactic of survival in a time of hangings and burnings of Negroes throughout the South. It was a low point for black people in America. Thomas Fortune, a young black editor of the New York Globe, testified before a Senate committee in 1883 about the situation of the Negro in the United States. He spoke of widespread poverty, of government betrayal, of desperate Negro attempts to educate themselves. The average wage of Negro farm laborers in the South was about 50 cents a day, Fortune said. He was usually paid in orders, not money, which he could use only at a store controlled by the planter, a system of fraud. The Negro farmer, to get the wherewithal to plant his crop, had to promise it to the store, And when everything was added up at the end of the year, he was in debt. So his crop was constantly owed to someone, and he was tied to the land, with the records kept by the planter and storekeeper, so that the Negroes are swindled and kept forever in debt. As for supposed laziness, I am surprised that a larger number of them do not go to fishing, hunting, and loafing. Fortune spoke of the penitentiary system of the South, with its infamous chain gang, the object being to terrorize the blacks and furnish victims for contractors who purchase the labor of these wretches from the state for a song. The white man who shoots a Negro always goes free, while the Negro who steals a hog is sent to the chain gang for 10 years. Many Negroes fled. About 6,000 black people left Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, and migrated to Kansas to escape violence and poverty. Frederick Douglass and some other leaders thought this was a wrong tactic, but migrants rejected such advice. "We have found no leader to trust but God overhead of us," one said. Henry Adams, another black migrant, illiterate, a veteran of the Union Army, told a Senate committee in 1880 why he left Shreveport, Louisiana. "We see that the whole South, every state in the South, had got into the hands of the very men that held us slaves." Even in the worst periods, Southern Negroes continued to meet, to organize in self-defense. Herbert Apthecker reprints 13 documents of meetings, petitions, and appeals of Negroes in the 1880s in Baltimore, Louisiana, the Carolinas, Virginia, Georgia, Florida, Texas, Kansas, showing the spirit of defiance and resistance of blacks all over the South. This in the face of over 100 lynchings a year by this time. Despite the apparent hopelessness of this situation, there were black leaders who thought Booker T. Washington wrong in advocating caution and moderation. John Hope, a young black man in Georgia, who heard Washington's Cotton Exposition speech, told students at a Negro college in Nashville, Tennessee, "If we are not striving for equality, in heaven's name, for what are we living? I regard it as cowardly and dishonest for any of our colored men to tell white people or colored people that we are not struggling for equality. Yes, my friends, I want equality, nothing less. Now, catch your breath, for I am going to use an adjective. I am going to say we demand social equality. I am no wild beast, nor am I an unclean thing. Rise, brothers. Come, let us possess this land. Be discontented. Be dissatisfied. Be as restless as the tempestuous billows on the boundless sea. Let your discontent break mountain high against the wall of prejudice and swamp it to the very foundation." Another black man who came to teach at Atlanta University, W.E.B. Du Bois, saw the late 19th century betrayal of the Negro as part of a larger happening in the United States, something happening not only to poor blacks, but to poor whites. In his book, Black Reconstruction, written in 1935, he said, "God wept, but that mattered little to an unbelieving age. What mattered most was that the world wept, and still is weeping, and blind with tears and blood. For there began to rise in America in 1876 a new capitalism and a new enslavement of labor." Du Bois saw this new capitalism as part of a process of exploitation and bribery taking place in all the civilized countries of the world. Home labor in cultured lands, appeased and misled by a ballot whose power the dictatorship of vast capital strictly curtailed, was bribed by high wage and political office to unite in an exploitation of white, yellow, brown, and black labor in lesser hands. Was Du Bois right that in that growth of American capitalism before and after the Civil War, whites as well as blacks were, in some sense, becoming slaves? Chapter 10, The Other Civil War. A sheriff in the Hudson River Valley near Albany, New York, about to go into the hills in the fall of 1839 to collect back rents from tenants on the enormous Rensselaer estate, was handed a letter. The tenants have organized themselves into a body and resolved not to pay any more rent until they can be redressed of their grievances. The tenants now assume the right of doing to their landlord as he has for a long time done for them, viz., as they please. You need not think this to be child's play. If you come out in your official capacity, I would not pledge for your safe return. A tenant. When a deputy arrived in the farming area with writs demanding the rent, farmers suddenly appeared, assembled by the blowing of tin horns. They seized his writs and burned them. That December, a sheriff and a mounted posse of 500 rode into the farm country, but found themselves in the midst of shrieking tin horns, 1,800 farmers blocking their path, 600 more blocking their rear, all mounted, armed with pitchforks and clubs. The sheriff and his posse turned back, the rear guard parting to let them through. This was the start of the anti-renter movement in the Hudson Valley, described by Henry Christman in Tin Horns and Calico. It was a protest against the patroonship system, which went back to the 1600s, when the Dutch ruled New York, a system where, as Christman describes it, a few families, intricately intermarried, controlled the destinies of 300,000 people and ruled in almost kingly splendor nearly 2 million acres of land. The tenants paid taxes and rents. The largest manor was owned by the Rensselaer family, which ruled over about 80,000 tenants and had accumulated a fortune of $41 million. The landowner, as one sympathizer of the tenants put it, could swill his wine, loll on his cushions, fill his life with society, food, and culture, and ride his barouche and 5 saddle horses along the beautiful river valley and up to the backdrop of the mountain. By the summer of 1839, the tenants were holding their first mass meeting. The economic crisis of 1837 had filled the area with unemployed seeking land, on top of the layoffs accompanying the completion of the Erie Canal after the first wave of railroad building ended. That summer the tenants resolved, "We will take up the ball of the revolution where our fathers stopped it, and roll it to the final consummation of freedom and independence of the masses." Certain men in the farm country became leaders and organizers. Smith Boughton, a country doctor on horseback, Ainge de Vere, a revolutionary Irishman. De Vere had seen monopoly of land and industry bring misery to the slum dwellers of London, Liverpool, and Glasgow, had agitated for change, had been arrested for sedition, and fled to America. He was invited to address a 4th of July rally of farmers in Rensselaerville, where he warned his listeners, "If you permit unprincipled and ambitious men to monopolize the soil, they will become masters of the country in the certain order of cause and effect." Thousands of farmers in Rensselaer country were organized into anti-rent associations to prevent the landlords from evicting. They agreed on calico Indian costumes, symbol of the Boston Tea Party, and recalling original ownership of the soil. The tin horn represented an Indian call to arms. Soon, 10,000 men were trained and ready. Organizing went on in county after county, in dozens of towns along the Hudson. Handbills appeared. "Attention, anti-renters, awake, arouse. Strike till the last armed foe expires. Strike for your altars and your fires. Strike for the green graves of your sires. God and your happy homes." Sheriffs and deputy sheriffs trying to serve writs on farmers were surrounded by calico-clad riders who had been summoned by tin horns sounding in the countryside, then tarred and feathered. The New York Herald, once sympathetic, now deplored the insurrectionary spirit of the mountaineers. One of the most hated elements of the lease gave the landlord the right to the timber on all the farms. A man sent onto a tenant's land to gather wood for the landlord was killed. Tension rose. A farm boy was killed mysteriously. No one knew by whom. But Dr. Boughton was jailed. The governor ordered artillerymen into action, and a company of cavalry came up from New York City. Petitions for an anti-rent bill, signed by 25,000 tenants, were put before the legislature in 1845. The bill was defeated. A kind of guerrilla war resumed in the country, between bands of Indians and sheriff's posses. Boughton was kept in jail 7 months, 4.5 months of that in heavy irons, before being released on bail. 4th of July meetings in 1845, attended by thousands of farmers, pledged continued resistance. When a deputy sheriff tried to sell the livestock of a farmer named Moses Earle, who owed $60 rent on 160 stony acres, there was a fight and the deputy was killed. Similar attempts to sell livestock for rent payments were thwarted again and again. The governor sent 300 troops in, declaring a state of rebellion existed, and soon almost 100 anti-renters went to jail. Smith Boughton was brought to trial. He was charged with taking papers from a sheriff, but declared by the judge to have in fact committed high treason, rebellion against your government, and armed insurrection, and sentenced to life imprisonment. Those Indians, found to be armed and disguised at Moses Earle's farm, where the deputy had been killed, were declared by the judge to be guilty of murder, and the jury was so instructed. All were found guilty, and the judge sentenced 4 to life imprisonment and 2 to be hanged. 2 of the leaders were told to write letters urging the anti-renters to disband as their only chance to escape heavy sentences. They wrote the letters. The power of the law thus crushed the anti-rent movement. It was intended to make clear that farmers could not win by fighting, that they must confine their efforts to voting, to acceptable methods of reform. In 1845, the anti-renters elected 14 members to the state legislature. Governor Silas Wright now commuted to life imprisonment the 2 death sentences and asked the legislature to give relief to the tenants, to end the feudal system in the Hudson Valley. Proposals to break up the huge estates on the death of the owners were defeated, but the legislature voted to make illegal the selling of tenant property for non-payment of rent. A constitutional convention that year outlawed new feudal leases. The next governor, elected in 1846 with anti-rent support, had promised to pardon the anti-rent prisoners, and he did. Throngs of farmers greeted them on their release. Court decisions in the 1850s began to limit the worst features of the manorial system without changing the fundamentals of landlord-tenant relations. Sporadic farmer resistance to the collection of back rents continued into the 1860s. As late as 1869, bands of Indians were still assembling to thwart sheriffs acting for a Rich Valley landowner named Walter Church. In the early 1880s, a deputy sheriff trying to dispossess a farmer on behalf of Church was killed by shotgun fire. By this time, most leases had passed into the hands of the farmers. In 3 of the main anti-rent counties, of 12,000 farmers, only 2,000 remained under lease. The farmers had fought, been crushed by the law, their struggle diverted into voting, and the system stabilized by enlarging the class of small landowners, leaving the basic structure of rich and poor intact. It was a common sequence in American history. Around the time of the anti-renter movement in New York, there was excitement in Rhode Island over Dorr's Rebellion. As Marvin Gettleman points out in The Dorr Rebellion, it was both a movement for electoral reform and an example of radical insurgency. It was prompted by the Rhode Island Charter's rule that only owners of land could vote. As more people left the farm for the city, as immigrants came to work in the mills, the disenfranchised grew. Seth Luther, self-educated carpenter in Providence and spokesman for working people, wrote in 1833 the Address on the Right of Free Suffrage, denouncing the monopoly of political power by the mushroom lordlings, sprigs of nobility, small potato aristocrats of Rhode Island. He urged non-cooperation with the government, refusing to pay taxes or to serve in the militia. Why, he asked, should 12,000 working people in Rhode Island, without the vote, submit to 5,000 who had land and could vote? Thomas Dorr, a lawyer from a well-to-do family, became a leader of the suffrage movement. Working people formed the Rhode Island Suffrage Association, and in the spring of 1841, thousands paraded in Providence carrying banners and signs for electoral reform. Going outside the legal system, they organized their own People's Convention and drafted a new constitution without property qualifications for voting. In early 1842, they invited votes on the Constitution. 14,000 voted for it, including about 5,000 with property. Therefore, a majority, even of those legally entitled to vote by the charter. In April, they held an unofficial election in which Dorr ran unopposed for governor, and 6,000 people voted for him. The governor of Rhode Island, in the meantime, got the promise of President John Tyler that in the case of rebellion, federal troops would be sent. There was a clause in the U.S. Constitution to meet just that kind of situation, providing for federal intervention to quell local insurrections on request of a state government. Ignoring this, on May 3, 1842, the Dorr forces held an inauguration with a great parade of artisans, shopkeepers, mechanics, and militia marching through Providence. The newly elected People's Legislature was convened. Dorr led a fiasco of an attack on the state arsenal, his cannon misfiring. Dorr's arrest was ordered by the regular governor, and he went into hiding outside the state, trying to raise military support. Despite the protests of Dorr and a few others, the People's Constitution kept the word white in its clause designating voters. Angry Rhode Island blacks now joined the militia units of the Law and Order Coalition, which promised that a new constitutional convention would give them the right to vote. When Dorr returned to Rhode Island, he found several hundred of his followers, mostly working people, willing to fight for the People's Constitution, but there were thousands in the regular militia on the side of the state. The rebellion disintegrated, and Dorr again fled Rhode Island. Martial law was declared. One rebel soldier, captured, was blindfolded and put before a firing squad, which fired with blank bullets. 100 other militia were taken prisoner. One of them described their being bound by ropes into platoons of 8, marched on foot 16 miles to Providence. Threatened and pricked by the bayonet if we lagged from fatigue, the rope severely chafing our arms, the skin off mine. No water till we reached Greenville, no food until the next day, and after being exhibited, were put into state prison. A new constitution offered some reform. It still gave over-representation to the rural areas, limited the vote to property owners or those who paid a $1 poll tax, and would let naturalized citizens vote only if they had $134 in real estate. In the elections of early 1843, the Law and Order group, opposed by former Dorrites, used intimidation of state militia, of employees by employers, of tenants by landlords, to get out their vote. It lost in the industrial towns, but got the vote of the agrarian areas and won all major offices. Dorr returned to Rhode Island in the fall of 1843. He was arrested on the streets of Providence and tried for treason. The jury, instructed by the judge to ignore all political arguments and consider only whether Dorr had committed certain overt acts, which he never denied committing, found him guilty, whereupon the judge sentenced him to life imprisonment at hard labor. He spent 20 months in jail, and then a newly elected law and order governor, anxious to end Dorr's martyrdom, pardoned him. Armed force had failed. The ballot had failed. The courts had taken the side of the conservatives. The Dorr movement now went to the U.S. Supreme Court via a trespass suit by Martin Luther against law and order militiamen, charging that the people's government was the legitimate government in Rhode Island in 1842. Daniel Webster argued against the Dorrites. If people could claim a constitutional right to overthrow an existing government, Webster said, there would be no more law and no more government. There would be anarchy. In its decision, the Supreme Court established Luther v. Borden, 1849, a long-lasting doctrine. It would not interfere in certain political questions to be left to executive and legislature. The decision reinforced the essentially conservative nature of the Supreme Court, that on critical issues, war and revolution, it would defer to the President and Congress. The stories of the anti-renter movement and Dorr's Rebellion are not usually found in textbooks on United States history. In these books, given to millions of young Americans, there is little on class struggle in the 19th century. The period before and after the Civil War is filled with politics, elections, slavery, and the race question. Even where specialized books on the Jacksonian period deal with labor and economic issues, they center on the presidency and thus perpetuate the traditional dependency on heroic leaders rather than people's struggles. Andrew Jackson said he spoke, "For the humble members of society, the farmer, mechanics, and laborers." He certainly did not speak for the Indians being pushed off their lands or slaves. But the tensions aroused by the developing factory system, the growing immigration, required that the government develop a mass base of support among whites. Jacksonian democracy did just that. Politics in this period of the 1830s and 1840s, according to Douglas Miller, a specialist in the Jacksonian period, the birth of modern America, had become increasingly centered around creating a popular image and flattering the common man. Miller is dubious, however, about the accuracy of that phrase, Jacksonian democracy. Parades, picnics, and campaigns of personal slander characterized Jacksonian politicking. But although both parties aimed their rhetoric at the people and mouthed the sacred shibboleths of democracy, this did not mean that the common man ruled America. The professional politicians coming to the fore in the 20s and 30s, though sometimes self-made, were seldom ordinary. Both major parties were controlled largely by men of wealth and ambition. Lawyers, newspaper editors, merchants, industrialists, large landowners, and speculators dominated the Democrats as well as the Whigs. Jackson was the first president to master the liberal rhetoric, to speak for the common man. This was a necessity for political victory when the vote was being demanded, as in Rhode Island, by more and more people, and state legislatures were loosening voting restrictions. As another Jacksonian scholar, Robert Remini, the age of Jackson, says, after studying electoral figures for 1828 and 1832, Jackson himself enjoyed widespread support that ranged across all classes and sections of the country. He attracted farmers, mechanics, laborers, professionals, and even businessmen. And all this without Jackson being clearly pro or anti-labor, pro or anti-business, pro or anti-lower, middle, or upper class. It has been demonstrated that he was a strike breaker. Jackson sent troops to control rebellious workers on the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal. Yet, at different times, he and the Democrats received the backing of organized labor. It was the new politics of ambiguity, speaking for the lower and middle classes to get their support in times of rapid growth and potential turmoil. The two-party system came into its own in this time. To give people a choice between two different parties and allow them, in a period of rebellion, to choose the slightly more democratic one was an ingenious mode of control. Like so much in the American system, it was not devilishly contrived by some master plotters. It developed naturally out of the needs of the situation. Remini compares the Jacksonian Democrat Martin Van Buren, who succeeded Jackson as president, with the Austrian conservative statesman Metternich. Like Metternich, who was seeking to thwart revolutionary discontent in Europe, Van Buren and similar politicians were attempting to banish political disorder from the United States by a balance of power achieved through two well-organized and active parties. The Jacksonian idea was to achieve stability and control by winning to the Democratic Party the middling interest and especially the substantial yeomanry of the country by prudent, judicious, well-considered reform. That is, reform that would not yield too much. These were the words of Robert Rantoul, a reformer, corporation lawyer, and Jacksonian Democrat. It was a forecast of the successful appeal of the Democratic Party, and at times the Republican Party, in the 20th century. Such new forms of political control were needed in the turbulence of growth, the possibility of rebellion. Now there were canals, railroads, the telegraph. In 1790, fewer than 1 million Americans lived in cities. In 1840, the figure was 11 million. New York had 130,000 people in 1820, 1 million by 1860. And while the traveler Alexis de Tocqueville had expressed astonishment at the general equality of condition among the people, he was not very good at numbers, his friend Beaumont said, and his observation was not in accord with the facts, according to Edward Pessin, a historian of Jacksonian society, Jacksonian America. In Philadelphia, working-class families lived 55 to a tenement, usually one room per family, with no garbage removal, no toilets, no fresh air or water. There was fresh water newly pumped from the Schuylkill River, but it was going to the homes of the rich. In New York, you could see the poor lying in the streets with the garbage. There were no sewers in the slums, and filthy water drained into yards and alleys, into the cellars where the poorest of the poor lived, bringing with it a typhoid epidemic in 1837, typhus in 1842. In the cholera epidemic of 1832, the rich fled the city. The poor stayed and died. These poor could not be counted on as political allies of the government, but they were there, like slaves or Indians, invisible ordinarily, a menace if they rose. There were more solid citizens, however, who might give steady support to the system, better paid workers, land-owning farmers. Also, there was the new urban white-collar worker, born in the rising commerce of the time, described by Thomas Cochrane and William Miller, the Age of Enterprise. Dressed in drab alpaca, hunched over a high desk, this new worker credited and debited, indexed and filed, wrote and stamped invoices, acceptances, bills of lading, receipts. Adequately paid, he had some extra money and leisure time. He patronized sporting events and theaters, savings banks and insurance companies. He read Day's New York Sun or Bennett's Herald, and penny press supported by advertising, filled with police reports, crime stories, etiquette advice for the rising bourgeoisie. This was the advance guard of a growing class of white-collar workers and professionals in America who would be wooed enough and paid enough to consider themselves members of the bourgeois class and to give support to that class in times of crisis. The opening of the West was being helped by mechanization of the farm. Iron plows cut plowing time in half. By the 1850s, John Deere Company was turning out 10,000 plows a year. Cyrus McCormick was making 1,000 mechanical reapers a year in his factory in Chicago. A man with a sickle could cut half an acre of wheat in a day. With a reaper, he could cut 10 acres. Turnpikes, canals, and railroads were bringing more people west, more products east, and it became important to keep that new West tumultuous and unpredictable under control. When colleges were established out west, Eastern businessmen, as Cochran and Miller say, were determined from the start to control Western education. Edward Everett, the Massachusetts politician and orator, spoke in 1833 on behalf of giving financial aid to Western colleges. "Let no Boston capitalist, then let no man who has a large stake in New England, think that he is called upon to exercise his liberality at a distance toward those in whom he has no concern. They ask you to give security to your own property by diffusing the means of light and truth throughout the region, where so much of the power to preserve or to shake it resides." The capitalists of the East were conscious of the need for this security to your own property. As technology developed, more capital was needed, more risks had to be taken, and a big investment needed stability. In an economic system not rationally planned for human need, but developing fitfully, chaotically out of the profit motive, there seemed to be no way to avoid recurrent booms and slumps. There was a slump in 1837, another in 1853. One way to achieve stability was to decrease competition, organize the businesses, move toward monopoly. In the mid-1850s, price agreements and mergers became frequent. The New York Central Railroad was a merger of many railroads. The American Brass Association was formed to meet ruinous competition, it said. The Hampton County Cotton Spinners Association was organized to control prices, and so was the American Iron Association. Another way to minimize risks was to make sure the government played its traditional role, going back to Alexander Hamilton and the First Congress, of helping the business interests. State legislatures gave charters to corporations, giving them legal rights to conduct business, raise money, at first special charters, then general charters, so that any business meeting certain requirements could incorporate. Between 1790 and 1860, 2,300 corporations were chartered. Railroad men traveled to Washington and to state capitals armed with money, shares of stock, free railroad passes. Between 1850 and 1857, they got 25 million acres of public land free of charge and millions of dollars in bonds, loans from the state legislatures. In Wisconsin in 1856, the La Crosse and Milwaukee Railroad got 1 million acres free by distributing about $900,000 in stocks and bonds to 59 assemblymen, 13 senators, and the governor. 2 years later, the railroad was bankrupt and the bonds were worthless. In the East, mill owners had become powerful and organized. By 1850, 15 Boston families, called the Associates, controlled 20% of the cotton spindlage in the United States, 39% of insurance capital in Massachusetts, 40% of banking resources in Boston. In the school books, those years are filled with the controversy over slavery. But on the eve of the Civil War, it was money and profit, not the movement against slavery, that was uppermost in the priorities of the men who ran the country. As Cochran and Miller put it, "Webster was the hero of the North, not Emerson, Parker, Garrison, or Phillips. Webster, the tariff man, the land speculator, the corporation lawyer, politician for the Boston Associates, inheritor of Hamilton's coronet. "The great object of government," said he, "is the protection of property at home and respect and renown abroad." For these he preached union. For these he surrendered the fugitive slave. They describe the Boston rich. "Living sumptuously on Beacon Hill, admired by their neighbors for their philanthropy and their patronage of art and culture, these men traded in State Street, while overseers ran their factories, managers directed their railroads, agents sold their water power and real estate." They were absentee landlords in the most complete sense. Uncontaminated by the diseases of the factory town, they were also protected from hearing the complaints of their workers or suffering mental depression from dismal and squalid surroundings. In the metropolis, art, literature, education, science flowered in the golden day. In the industrial towns, children went to work with their fathers and mothers. Schools and doctors were only promises. A bed of one's own was a rare luxury. Ralph Waldo Emerson described Boston in those years. "There is a certain poor smell in all the streets. In Beacon Street and Mount Vernon, as well as in the lawyers' offices, and the wharves, and the same meanness and sterility, and leave all hope behind, as one finds in a boot manufacturer's premises." The preacher Theodore Parker told his congregation, "Money is this day the strongest power of the nation." The attempts at political stability, at economic control, did not quite work. The new industrialism, the crowded cities, the long hours in the factories, the sudden economic crises leading to high prices and lost jobs, the lack of food and water, the freezing winters, the hot tenements in the summer, the epidemics of disease, the deaths of children, these led to sporadic reactions from the poor. Sometimes there were spontaneous, unorganized uprisings against the rich. Sometimes the anger was deflected into racial hatred for blacks, religious warfare against Catholics, nativist fury against immigrants. Sometimes it was organized into demonstrations and strikes. Jacksonian democracy had tried to create a consensus of support for the system to make it secure. Blacks, Indians, women, and foreigners were clearly outside the consensus. But also, white working people, in large numbers, declared themselves outside. The full extent of the working-class consciousness of those years, as of any years, is lost in history. But fragments remain and make us wonder how much of this always existed underneath the very practical silence of working people. In 1827, an address before the mechanics and working classes of Philadelphia was recorded, written by an unlettered mechanic, probably a young shoemaker, who said, "We find ourselves oppressed on every hand. We labor hard in producing all the comforts of life for the enjoyment of others, while we ourselves obtain but a scanty portion, and even that, in the present state of society, depends on the will of employers." Frances Wright of Scotland, an early feminist and utopian socialist, was invited by Philadelphia workingmen to speak on the 4th of July, 1829, to one of the first citywide associations of labor unions in the United States. She asked if the revolution had been fought to crush down the sons and daughters of your country's industry under neglect, poverty, vice, starvation, and disease? She wondered if the new technology was not lowering the value of human labor, making people appendages to machines, crippling the minds and bodies of child laborers. Later that year, George Henry Evans, a printer, editor of the Working Man's Advocate, wrote, "The Working Men's Declaration of Independence, among its list of facts submitted to candid and impartial fellow citizens. 1. The laws for levying taxes are operating almost oppressively on one class of society. 3. The laws for private incorporation are all partial, favoring one class of society to the expense of the other. 6. The laws have deprived 9/10 of the members of the body politic, who are not wealthy, of the equal means to enjoy life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The lien law in favor of the landlords against tenants is one illustration among innumerable others. Evans believed that all on arriving at adult age are entitled to equal property. A citywide trades union in Boston in 1834, including mechanics from Charlestown and women shoe binders from Lynn, referred to the Declaration of Independence. We hold that laws which have a tendency to raise any peculiar class above their fellow citizens by granting special privileges are contrary to and in defiance of those primary principles. Our public system of education, which so liberally endows those seminaries of learning, are only accessible to the wealthy, while our common schools are so ill provided for. Thus, even in childhood, the poor are apt to think themselves inferior. In his book, Most Uncommon Jacksonians, Edward Pessin says, "The leaders of the Jacksonian labor movement were radicals. How else describe men who believed American society to be torn with social conflict, disfigured by the misery of the masses, and dominated by a greedy elite whose power over every aspect of American life was based on private property?" Episodes of insurrection of that time have gone unrecorded in traditional histories. Such was the riot in Baltimore in the summer of 1835, when the Bank of Maryland collapsed and its depositors lost their savings. Convinced that a great fraud had taken place, a crowd gathered and began breaking the windows of officials associated with the bank. When the rioters destroyed a house, the militia attacked, killing some 20 people, wounding 100. The next evening, other houses were attacked. The events were reported in Niles' Weekly Register, an important newspaper of that time. Last night, Sunday, at dark, the attack was renewed upon Reverdy Johnson's house. There was now no opposition. It was supposed that several thousand people were spectators of the scene. The house was soon entered, and its furniture, a very extensive law library, and all its contents were cast forth, a bonfire made of them in front of the house. The whole interior of the house was torn out and cast upon the burning pile. The marble portico in front and a great portion of the front wall were torn down by about 11 o'clock. They proceeded to that of the mayor of the city, Jesse Hunt, Esquire, broke it open, took out the furniture, and burnt it before the door. During those years, trade unions were forming. Philip Foner's History of the Labor Movement in the U.S. tells the story in rich detail. The courts called them conspiracies to restrain trade, and therefore illegal, as when in New York 25 members of the Union Society of Journeymen Tailors were found guilty of conspiracy to injure trade, riot, assault, battery. The judge, levying fines, said, "In this favored land of law and liberty, the road to advancement is open to all. Every American knows that, or ought to know that he has no better friend than the laws, and that he needs no artificial combination for his protection. They are of foreign origin, and I am led to believe mainly upheld by foreigners." A handbill was then circulated throughout the city. "The rich against the poor. Judge Edwards, the tool of the aristocracy against the people, mechanics and workingmen. A deadly blow has been struck at your liberty. They have established the precedent that workingmen have no right to regulate the price of labor, or, in other words, the rich are the only judges of the wants of the poor man." At City Hall Park, 27,000 people gathered to denounce the court decision and elected a committee of correspondents, which organized 3 months later a convention of mechanics, farmers, and working men, elected by farmers and working people in various towns in New York State. The convention met in Utica, drew up a Declaration of Independence from existing political parties, and established an Equal Rights Party. Although they ran their own candidates for office, there was no great confidence in the ballot as a way of achieving change.